Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is now at home recuperating from a cracked pelvis. She hopes to be back on the air next week. We all hope so, too. The late Senator Ted Kennedy called guaranteed health care for every American the cause of his life. In this hour, we'll discuss how his death may affect the passage of health care legislation this year and the controversy over how best to fill his vacant Senate seat. Joining me in the studio, E.J. Dionne of the Brookings Institution and the Washington Post, and Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine. And joining us from a studio at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is David Gergen, a CNN commentator and a professor of public service at the John F. Kennedy School of Government. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Good morning.
To be here.
Later
Thank
in this
you.
Hour, we'll invite our listeners to join our conversation. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Well, first, let's talk for just a few minutes with Frank Phillips, who's on the phone from Boston. He is the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Frank, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Susan.
Now, before he died, Senator Kennedy asked the Massachusetts legislature to change the law so that Governor Patrick could appoint his replacement. How is that going?
It's meeting some resistance up here. It's hard to say. The legislature has been out. But these lawmakers have, done some controversial things here. They've raised taxes, slashed budgets. They've been out in their districts. They know people are angry. They just don't want another controversial issue thrown on the plate and giving opponents a toehold to get into races and to give them any kind of political problems. So I think they're approaching it with some hesitancy. But I think the pressure is mounting on them to do something. They don't want to be held responsible. If health care goes down on a tie vote and Massachusetts doesn't have two votes there, I think they're wise enough to know that they would be they'd be looking pretty bad on that.
Now, we know that the special election will go ahead regardless in January 19th or 26th. And the question is an interim appointment to fill in until the special elections is held. Now, do you have any sense of how the people of Massachusetts feel about this, whether they want an interim appointment to be made?
It depends who you talk to. I think it's, it really hasn't sunk in. I think the senator's death has sort of put that on hold. I wouldn't venture forth to say, they're for overwhelmingly or against it. I think the people who are concerned about public policy and politics are, and I think there is an argument above the partisan battle about it, that Massachusetts should be represented, and this is Kennedy's vote, essentially, and it should be represented in the Senate, particularly when health care is taken up.
Now, if an interim appointment is made, who are the names? What are the names that you hear of people who might get this interim appointment? And the general feeling is this person would make a commitment to not then run in the special election. Who might get the interim appointment?
Well, first of all, and I haven't checked in with the governor recently, but I was with him late last week privately, and I just asked him, and he threw up his arms and said, he hasn't even thought about it. So it's all speculation, and it's names that people are putting forward. One is former Governor Michael Dukakis. He certainly has national stature. Healthcare reform was as passionate for him as it was for Kennedy going way back. He doesn't have future political ambitions. He's 75 years old. It would be a nice way to cap off his career. There are others. People would want Vicky Kennedy to take it, but I think she's pretty well indicated she does not want to get involved in that or in the special election.
And so, thinking about the special election, who are the Democrats who are likely to seek the nomination for the Kennedy seat?
That all depends on the Kennedy family, and particularly Joe Kennedy at this point. He is ambivalent about getting in this race. Family members are trying to urge him, saying that this is the Kennedy seat for almost 60 years, and he should do it and keep the Kennedy influence going in Massachusetts. There are some congressmen, including the dean of the delegation, Ed Markey, Michael Capuano, who took Joe Kennedy's place in the House, and Stephen Lynch, who took Joe Moakley's place from South Boston. Those three are looking at it. A lot of it depending on whether Joe Kennedy gets in it. We also have the Attorney General Martha Coakley, who says she'll run one way or the other, no matter who's in it. Steve Lynch has indicated that. The other two, Capuano and Markey, said they won't run if Joe Kennedy gets into it.
One last question. Given the power of the Kennedy name in Massachusetts, if Joe Kennedy decides to seek the nomination, is it a given that he'll win it?
I think he'd be an overwhelming favorite. And we're coming off the senator's death and the celebration of his life. He has access to a huge Kennedy fundraising operation that expands over the country, that he could raise a lot of money. He is a very dynamic campaigner. He's also can be clumsy at times. Things can blow up in his face because of his own self-inflicted problems. But he would be a very strong candidate. Nothing's certain, particularly in Massachusetts politics. So I wouldn't say it's a certainty, but it would be a pretty strong bet that he would win it.
Someone named Kennedy has held that seat since 1952, since the election in 1952, with the exception of just 2 years when an appointed senator held it, waiting for Ted Kennedy to get old enough to take the seat. Frank Phillips, thanks so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure.
Frank Phillips is the State House Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Karen Tumulty, Ted Kennedy has effectively been away from Washington for some time because he was battling the illness that finally took his life last week. So how much difference when it comes to an issue like health care reform? How much difference does it make now that he has passed away?
You know, you're right. He's been missed all year. And I think specifically he was missed greatly when his committee was struggling to produce its bill. I think it would have been a lot more, it would have run more smoothly had the senator been there. The most immediate and tangible effect is that the Senate has now lost its 60th Democrat, which means that was the number of votes it takes to overcome a filibuster, assuming that the entire caucus holds together on that vote on health care, which is a big, big assumption. And beyond that, you know, we've certainly heard a lot of speculation among the pundits and even among some of his Senate colleagues that somehow Ted Kennedy's death will have everyone, you know, put their partisanship and their ideological differences aside and somehow come together to do this in his memory as a tribute to him. That is not generally the way the Senate works. And certainly it's very rare that a politician casts a vote with somebody else's legacy in mind.
David Gergen, do you think that there are any Republicans in the House or the Senate whose position on health care reform is likely to be changed or affected in any way because of this sense that Ted Kennedy has passed away and this was the cause of his lifetime?
I must say, Susan, at this point, I don't see anyone who's moved. But frankly, I don't see moderate Democrats who've moved either. We've had this enormous outpouring of affection for Teddy Kennedy. Clearly, the country was moved by it. Many people were glued to television sets all weekend. But so far, I haven't seen it translate into a real push or transform the health care debate. And just to follow up on one thing Karen said, not only was Ted Kennedy missed in the Senate over these last few months, but I think, and EJ may have a view on this as well, my sense is he would have been an enormous asset to the White House in counseling them on how to handle this issue over the last several months had he been present, and that they sorely needed that counseling. They missed both Tom Daschle and Ted Kennedy, but Ted Kennedy, who would have understood so well the currents in the Senate, the count, and that sort of thing, I think could have given them a lot of help on how to take it to the country and, indeed, how to work the legislative process.
EJ, in your column in the Washington Post this morning, you offer some advice to President Obama in his effort to get this health care legislation moving again. What do you suggest he do?
Well, first of all, I could say I agree with David that the absence of both Kennedy and Daschle hurt this effort, in part because the Obama White House was missing their advice. Daschle is obviously talking to them a lot, and there are signs that he's going to get more involved. On the other hand, I think it's important not to have illusions about the nature of this debate. I think most Republicans decided early on, for reasons of both politics and principle, that they were going to try to stop this. There are very few Republicans who want to pass this, and even Ted Kennedy, I think, would have had limited capacity to change that. I think that where the president in the last month has sent a lot of mixed signals. I think a singular moment was that weekend when Secretary Sebelius and Robert Gibbs, the spokesman, went on TV and said, well, they're willing to negotiate away the public option. 24 hours later, liberals are up in arms, so they say, no, we're really for the public option. And number one, negotiating in public is never a good idea, and giving away stuff for nothing is never a good idea. And the paradox is they don't want the public option to be the centerpiece of this, and yet their own move made it that. So I think that what the president broadly has to do is not overlearn the Clinton lesson. He didn't want to present an unbelievably detailed bill and stand or fall on that. That made some sense. But between there and doing very little to make your views known, there's a lot of room. And I think he's got to come back fighting. If I could say one quick thing about Senator Kennedy's death, it did accomplish one thing from the point of view of supporters of this. It silenced the guns of August against health care, or if I can use another metaphor, it broke the August fever. There was this brief period when liberalism got a good run in the media. And despite the attacks on liberal media, most reporters are afraid of being called liberals, so liberalism doesn't get such a good run. I've never seen so much affection for liberalism in the mass media as I have in the last 3 days.
E.J. Dionne is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and a columnist for The Washington Post. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones and take some of your calls. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And we're joined by from Boston by David Gergen, who is, of course, a veteran of the White House and advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government. And with me in the studio, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and E.J. Dionne from The Washington Post and Brookings Institution. Well, David Gergen, the president Obama has had a tough August when it comes to health care. As Congress prepares to come back in about a week, where do you think this legislation stands? How badly do you think it's been damaged?
I think it's been hurt badly by August. I think it was not just the size of the resistance that showed up at these town hall meetings, but it was the intensity if the country has become increasingly polarized. The polarization now is at levels, I think, that almost exceed what we saw under George W. Bush. The left may have been energized by the last few days, as I think E.J. referenced that. This may have really inspired them or invigorated the left. But the right has been extremely invigorated over the last 3 or 4 weeks with these town hall meetings and the outbursts and that sort of thing. So I think the tides are moving in the wrong direction for President Obama. And I am absolutely persuaded that the president now must take charge when he returns. The few days when the Congress comes back are really critical for him to to call in Democrats and call in Republicans to the White House, figure out what he can get, and go out and champion it and really push hard with the country. He cannot continue to leave this process up to the vagaries of what happens on Capitol Hill as he has done. It has left him in a bargainless position.
But, you know, David, President Obama has done nothing but town hall meetings and interviews and press conferences.
That's not what I think.
Else is it that he needs to do?
He's got to have a plan, and he can't just go back out to the country and continue to repeat the kind of town halls he's been doing. That won't get anywhere. He's now got to play the inside game first and knock some heads together and figure out what it is he really stands for and what he insists on. E.J. Hicks' column, I thought, was right this morning about taking a page out of Kennedy, and that is, I think he's probably got to fight hard for the public option and give it up at the end. But this peremptory concession that they made with Sebelius and Gibbs is coming back to haunt them now. I think it's one of the few things he's got to bargain away in order to get something else. But he's first got to figure out what he stands for.
You know, it's back in May, someone very close to the White House on this issue told me that they were prepared to bargain away the public option. So it's been no secret in town that that's something they thought they might and very well were prepared to give up. Well, Karen, you follow this issue so closely. Do you think that President Obama is prepared to do what David Gergen says he should do, which is basically have his own plan?
You know, even before the circuses of August, top White House officials were saying privately that there was a great need for what they referred to as a restart in September. This, they were talking in terms of potentially an address to a joint session of Congress, you know, maybe taking down the negotiators to Andrews Air Force Base and locking them up and telling them they can't come out until they come up with a plan. But I do agree it is going to require the president being a lot more specific about what he will and will not accept. And I actually interviewed him on this subject in late July, and I asked him if maybe it had been a mistake to have been so vague in his approach. He was very defensive about that at the time. He said, look, we were always going to come down to the final 20% of this was going to be hard stuff. And had I laid out a detailed plan or not, we were going to be fighting over the same things. I think he was right then, but I do think that at this point the calculus has changed.
EJ?
Well, you know, we're talking a lot about Ted Kennedy's legacy, and you know, you have almost, we're so partisan, we're even arguing about the nature of the best parts of Ted Kennedy's legacy. And, you know, a lot of Republicans and some middle-of-the-road people say, well, it was his ability to reach out and work with Republicans. And liberals say it's because he was a real avatar fighter for liberalism and the dispossessed. Well, in fact, those two things went together, and that's, I think, what's forgotten in this argument. Kennedy knew where he wanted to get, and he was going to get as far as he could. But if he had to compromise to take two steps instead of three, once the fighting happened, he knew where the deal could be struck. And, you know, on this public plan, as David suggested, I just do not understand why they negotiated this in public. There's a good case to be made for the public plan in terms of controlling costs and expanding people's options. There are fallback positions that might be acceptable to supporters of the public plan. If you had a really strong trigger, such as the one that Senator Snowe, a Republican from Maine, has suggested, which would bring this into being if the insurance market failed, that may be a place where they could end up. But Lord knows, don't give everything away before you sit at the table.
And by the way, there is such a trigger on the Medicare prescription drug plan that would allow the government to come in and negotiate drug prices if the insurance companies couldn't handle it. And that trigger's never had to be used.
Here's an email. I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
Well, just one more footnote to this, what Karen was saying. I think it's also true that the health insurance industry would accept a trigger. That the public option built in as a trigger would be something early on, at least a few weeks ago, they felt that was a fair deal.
In the White House, here's what the White House might say if they had someone here in this conversation, which was that they never expected a public option to become the critical issue on which this debate would be focused. You know, last year during the campaign, there was rather limited discussion about a public option in the context of the health care overhaul he was talking about.
But, you know, the public option is already a compromise. Sometimes I think that the advocates of single payer should have stuck with single payer and really pushed hard for it, because the public option is already a compromise of a single payer system. And it says, look, instead of imposing it by law, we'll see what the market does. And if people move toward the government plan. They will, by their individual choices, decide in favor of single payer. But the public option was in the Hillary Clinton plan, it was in the John Edwards plan, and it was in the Barack Obama plan. And it was a bridge between, if you will, the middle position in the Democratic Party and the progressive position.
I can tell you, every time we do a show on health care on the Diane Rehm Show, we hear from listeners who are still strong supporters of a single payer or government-run health care plan. Well, here's an email from Jean, who writes us from Indiana. She says, where does Vice President Biden fit into the health care issue? I thought he was supposed to know how to work the Congress. David, where is Biden on this?
That's an interesting question. I don't think he's played a central role on this. You know, he's been off working the Iraq account, to a lesser extent Afghanistan, and he also is working some of these questions about the stimulus plan. But as best I can tell, he has not been a central player in the legislative strategy going forward. I think Rahm Emanuel has been the dominant player on the legislative strategy front.
You know, here's an amazing statistic from one of the news accounts this weekend. If Ted Kennedy's seat is filled by a gubernatorial appointment, 27% of Americans would be represented by an unelected senator, because we have appointed senators for New York and Illinois and Delaware and Colorado. We have one coming up from Florida. And I wonder, EJ, is this how it's supposed to work? Should people be upset that the Senate seats are being filled this way?
Well, 51 votes in the Senate represent about 19% of the whole population. So the Senate is so undemocratic to begin with that this is small change. You can blame the Obama administration for appointing so many senators and picking, you know, you started with our president, vice president, who came out of the Senate. You go down to Secretary of the Interior and others who have gone into the administration. So, on the Massachusetts business, I think this is a great case of political hypocrisy on both sides. That in 2004, when it looked like John Kerry could win, and he actually did come close to winning, Democrats in the Massachusetts legislature said, wait a minute, we don't want to elect a Democratic president, only lose the Senate. And the Senate looked to be closely divided. So they changed the law, said, no, the governor doesn't appoint. The governor then was Mitt Romney, so it would have been a Republican. The Republicans in the legislature said, this is a bad idea. You're changing the rules in the middle of the game. Now we go 5 years later, the two parties have totally switched sides, and that a lot of Democrats want to have the governor appoint because they don't want to lose that vote. And the Republicans are now great champions of the law they originally opposed. The one way to do this, Frank Phillips of the Globe suggested, is to make it all about health care and to say, look, yes, we're hypocrites in doing this. Yes, people can say whatever they want. But the fact is, one vote could really matter on health care, and pick someone with a background in health care to fill the seat. Mike Dukakis is an interesting choice and would be a good choice. There are others, but they got to fill that seat.
Yeah, let me ask you this, EJ. Are they, in fact, only one vote away? It seems to me that they might, in a filibuster, they might be several votes shy.
No, I agree with you, David. It might not come down to one, but if it did, and for example, I could imagine trading out Ben Nelson's vote, conservative Democrat from Nebraska. He might vote no before Olympia Snowe did. We don't know that. If it did come, you're going to be within a very close margin one way or the other. And you could also face a situation where some senators who would vote against the final bill, I'm talking about Democrats, might oppose a filibuster, stick with their party on the procedural issue, and then vote against the bill in the end. And there again, one vote could matter.
Now, Judy from Castleton, Virginia, has written us an email. She says, please explain why there's such importance placed on 60 votes when it seems to me that 51 would be a majority. Karen?
Because you cannot get past a filibuster if you have 60 votes. Now, there is a parliamentary procedure called, it's one of the great misnomers of legislative terminology, reconciliation, where you can do this under 51 votes, but it requires a lot of twisting and turning. It could potentially make the bill subject to a lot of challenges where it could be ripped to shreds. And the other thing is it makes the numbers more difficult to add up, because you have to make this balance as a budgetary item in 5 years instead
of 10.
Lots of
problems with reconciliation, but it sure sounds like that's the direction Democrats are headed.
It is certainly something they are now looking into. And there's actually talk of splitting the bill into two, and where you could essentially pass the budgetary parts under reconciliation and pass the other parts under regular order.
David, is it risky for Democrats? Would it be risky for them to go the reconciliation route, get 51 Democratic votes, not worry about attracting some Republicans?
It's highly risky. Let's start with fundamentals. If the public is not persuaded in the next few weeks that this bill is a good idea, and we see majorities against the bill, and the Democrats go the route of reconciliation, it's worth remembering that, you know, the old line from Thomas Jefferson, that great innovation should not be forced upon slim majorities, and that is the situation the Democrats would find themselves in. Just first of all, then you've got this to pass a huge bill affecting 17% of the economy in the teeth of public opposition is in itself a risky proposition, and that's when you will see some moderate Democrats begin to find ways to disappear on the bill. And I think that's what poses some problems for the Democrats. Can they? And then, of course, the second issue in reconciliation itself is, as Karen pointed out, the rules of reconciliation are so complex that you couldn't get the whole bill through on reconciliation probably. There would be pieces of it that would have to be left out. And to split the bill in two, to go part of it on reconciliation and then try to get Republican votes on the other part of it through a 60-vote process, I think calls into question just sort of the common sense. Are they really think Republicans are going to join in to pass half the bill after they run roughshod over them with reconciliation? I just think that's I doubt Republicans will see themselves as enablers. That would be the line used against them by Rush Limbaugh and others. If they vote to go along with that kind of procedure, so I think that this road ahead has a lot of perils. And why it's so important for the president to rally the Congress in a way and come up with a bill that he can take to the country and convince the country this is a good idea. He's got to get public opinion, the tides of public opinion, moving in another direction. It's really important.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. We'll go to the phones in just a minute. Karen?
Well, David raised an interesting point. But the last time we saw something of this scope pass Washington with a big bipartisan majority was tax reform in 1986. And former Senator—
1986. How many years ago was that? That was a couple decades ago.
But it was an interesting idea was raised yesterday in the New York Times on the op-ed page by former Senator Bill Bradley, who was there for that. And he said the way they got that done was by throwing things in there that both parties wanted. And there is one potential way he thinks to do it this time, which is to throw something into the bill that the Republicans very badly want. Throw in tort reform and see if—
Tort reform being limiting
malpractice suits, or perhaps setting up a separate court system to handle malpractice cases. Senator Bradley suggested that may be something that Republicans would find it very hard to vote against if it were in the bill.
EJ. But,
you know, David said something very interesting. He said, how would Republicans respond to Rush Limbaugh and what he would say about their trying to make a deal? Rush Limbaugh has become the infallible guide to the Republican Party. And that's, I think, the problem you're facing here. Paul Krugman had a very interesting column today where he said, I miss Richard Nixon. Not something he ever expected to say. Richard Nixon, of course, had a more progressive health care proposal, which Ted Kennedy always said he wished he had accepted way back in 1971 and 72. Nixon was way to the center and left of where Republicans are today. The Democrats are—
By the way,
in,
where the bill is today.
Yes, exactly. Where Democrats are today. Let me just finish, David. I'd love you to come back in on Nixon. You know, Democrats are in this fix because there aren't any Republicans willing to vote for this. Chuck Grassley and Mike Enzi are very conservative Republicans. They have strung these negotiations along and along and along without ever committing to vote for the final product. I think every Democrat in the Senate would rather have a few Republicans on here. They're still praying Olympia Snow might join them. It's a very different Republican Party from even the one that existed in 1986 that Bill Bradley wrote about in the Times.
David?
Well, it is an irony, of course, that the closest we've come to passing comprehensive health care reform with universal coverage was under Richard Nixon, and there was a chance of getting it. All sorts of things collapsed, of course, right, in the middle of that fight. And sadly, we walked away from it. But Nixon actually proposed employer mandates. He wanted universal coverage.
He was a socialist.
Exactly. But coming back to it, EJ's got a good point about Republicans. Republicans, they have not wanted to play ball with this. They have been appalled by aspects of the program. But, EJ, it's also true that the Democrats are divided. At this point, it's a very reasonable question whether a public option plan can pass the Senate with Democratic votes. And it's also a very interesting question, if you take public option out of the bill and pass it through the Senate, it's an interesting question whether it can pass the House without a public option in it.
But, of course, you could pass it with a public option in the House, without a public option in the Senate, and work out some compromise. It would probably not be a full public option in conference. Isn't that the kind of the scheme that we've seen coming if they get that far?
See, and that's what go ahead, David.
Yeah, well, the question is, but the Democrats are still divided over that. What would they do in conference? Would the liberal bloc of Democrats in the House insist upon a public option as a price for getting it done? I don't know whether they compromise or not.
But you know,
at the moment, the Democrats themselves are very divided as well.
I could see that. You know, we talked about how Senator Kennedy's death probably doesn't persuade any Republicans to change their views. I could see an appeal based on Senator Kennedy having some impact on Democrats and holding them together. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go straight to the phones and we'll read your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary, on the web at healthreform.org, by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Support for NPR comes from LendingTree, with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, presenting an in-depth look at the digital generation at edutopia.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count is a state-by-state look at child well-being and the important role of data, at aecf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're going to go to the phones to continue our conversation about Senator Ted Kennedy's legacy and the future of health care reform this year. Let's talk to Damon, calling us from Apex, North Carolina. Hi, Damon.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
As a libertarian, I never thought I'd say this, but E.J. Dion has been right all along. Everything he said, I've agreed with.
God bless you. I feel there's something else coming.
No, actually, what the Democrats should have done, here's the Democrats' problem, and that is in 2006 when Joe Lieberman was running for the Senate again and he lost to Ned Lamont in the primary, the Democrat Party establishment did not enforce any party discipline. And that told people like Max Baucus and Ben Nelson that they too could violate party discipline and nothing would happen to them. So the problem isn't that the Democrats lack 60 votes now that Ted Kennedy is dead. The problem is that the 58th, 59th, 57th votes are all very conservative Democrats who don't fear Barack Obama or Harry Reid. And I'd like EJ to comment upon that if he could.
All right, Damon, thanks for your call.
Well, this is when you trot out the old Will Rogers line, I don't belong to an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. And, you know, when you look at a party with a majority, the Republicans, when they had a majority in the House, actually had a lot of moderate members, and they lost their majority in part because all these moderates lost their seats. There is not a single Republican left in the House from New England. Similarly, the Democrats built this big majority by winning in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect a Democrat to win, such as Nebraska. I agree that you need more discipline in the party, and I actually think on health care, at the end, you're going to get more of it than anybody is predicting now, because every Democrat still remembers, even people who weren't in office then, what happened in 1994 when Bill Clinton couldn't get a health care bill through. Democrats looked like they could not govern. And I think at the left end of the party and the right end of the party, people are going to look at each other and say, we cannot fail again. And so I think discipline will be enforced. It'll be kind of self-enforced because they can't afford to lose this.
David, of course, you came into the Clinton White House after that debacle, and I wonder what you think the consequences would be for President Obama and for congressional Democrats if they don't get a health care bill passed when they go back to the midterm elections next year.
If this ends in complete failure, the president is going to be grievously wounded as a political leader. It's critical for him, for his presidency, as well as for the Democratic Party, to get something passed. Now, whether that something is a robust health care bill of the kind that he envisioned originally and Democratic leaders like Pelosi and Reid envisioned is a different question. My sense is if they get in health insurance passed, if they increase access to health coverage, even if it doesn't become totally universal in the early stages, if they get the costs down so people aren't as frightened of it out in the country, especially after these huge deficit projections, that would be politically very welcomed by the country, which would shore up the president. Would not be a huge victory for him, but would be a victory. And my sense, to go back to Damon's question, there's two types of discipline here. The one's the discipline that's exercised by the party, which isn't very much, frankly, and they haven't had it, as EJ points out. But there's also a discipline from the voters. And for these moderate Democrats to go in from these Senate seats or these House seats to go in and vote for a very robust bill that's like the House bill that's come through is to ask them to face the discipline of the voters. And they may lose a number of seats. That's one of the calculations the party has to. Are they willing to give up 20, 30, 40 seats in the House in order to get this passed or not? I'm not sure I know the answer to that question, but I sure know it's going to have to be part of the calculation.
The paradox is the public option properly defended is quite popular in the polls. In other words, so much of it depends on what people think is in the public option. People like the idea in principle of an extra choice in health care, so that some of these conservative votes, I'm not sure how much of it is looking at their own constituents and how much of it is looking at television and seeing right-wingers opposing this who would never vote for them in the first place. I just want to thank Damon, by the way, and tell him that the old Libertarian Review, which was one of my favorite magazines, even though it's sadly dead and even though I disagreed with it.
Karen, answer David's question for us. Is the White House and congressional Democratic leaders, are they prepared to give up 20, 30, 40 House seats if that's what it means to get a robust health care plan passed?
I think what is more likely to happen is that they give up parts of the health care plan, that they end up passing a smaller bill. Now, that has some advantages. You know, you could do some insurance market reforms. It wouldn't be as expensive to the federal government in the short term. The problem with that is that you're going to end up leaving people out. And the people who are most likely to get left out of a bill like this, who will end up without coverage, are older single adults, the type of people who have chronic illnesses, who are now showing up at emergency rooms and getting treatment anyway, not effectively, not efficiently. So in a lot of ways, health economists would tell you, you're going to be missing your opportunity to get costs down in the long run.
We have some listeners who weigh in on the moral dimension of this. Norman from Denton, Texas, sends us an email. There are still some people who don't make enough to get health care. We need to raise taxes. Are we willing to cover everybody or not? And Bill from Newport News, Virginia, sends us an email saying, health care is a moral issue and all Americans should support compassion over their fears and their taxes. Let's go back to the phones and take a call. Take a call from Jay. He's calling us from New Haven, Connecticut. Jay, you're on the air.
Thank you. My question is for David Gergen, and it's, why should the Democrats take Thomas Jefferson's and your advice about narrow majorities and big changes when President Bush and Dick Cheney got away with the exact opposite approach in pushing through major tax and fiscal reform, even though they didn't even win the popular vote?
Well, do they want to wind up with the reputation that George W. Bush wound up with? Is that what you're recommending?
No, I'm asking about getting health care reform.
Well, listen, it's pretty fundamental that if you're the leadership in Washington and you want to make dramatic reforms, that it's incumbent upon you to bring the public along with you. That's true whether you're trying to make reform domestically or whether you're trying to go to war. George W. Bush, for all sorts of reasons we could argue about for a long time, I think did it the wrong way in taking us into war in the way he did. And I think some of the other I think it turns out in the long run we didn't handle the prescription drugs program the right way. We should have paid for that. It got very expensive and all the rest. And he ran up huge deficits, as we all know. But that does not seem to me to be a recipe for how Barack Obama ought to conduct his presidency. He should take his lead out of Franklin Roosevelt or Lyndon Johnson or other Democrats who have brought huge domestic reforms. Franklin Roosevelt was a master at winning over the public on a huge government program called Social Security. He won the public over to his side, and they got it passed with large majorities. The big social legislation of the 20th century, if you look at it, Pat Moynihan taught me this lesson way back when I was in the Clinton White House. The major social legislation that's passed in the 20th century ultimately won supermajorities in the Senate because the presidents and their parties persuaded the country these were good ideas.
Well, here's another reason that health care is different. You pass a tax cut, and taxes are cut immediately. This legislation is going to take years, potentially even decades, to implement. And that's why you need public support all along the way, because what you don't want is to begin the process of health care reform and then have the next congressional election come along and then repeal of everything you've done. In fact, that's what happened to Michael Dukakis in Massachusetts. He passed an employer mandate there, and the next legislative session, they came right back and repealed it.
First of all, since when would be 58 or 59 votes be a narrow majority? 58 or 59 senators representing probably 60% or two-thirds of the population? Yes, David's right. FDR and LBJ picked up some Republican votes, but they had Democratic majorities in the Congress that Barack Obama could only dream about. And those Republicans were different. Fiorello LaGuardia and George Norris, two Republicans in the FDR era, were way to the left of most Democrats. It was a completely different party system. It's unfortunate. Everybody would like a bipartisan bill, but you need a strong center in the Republican Party to get that, and you just don't have a big centrist bloc in the Republican Party anymore.
You know, there's another issue Senator Kennedy worked on for years, and that is the issue of immigration reform. Is there an impact now with his passing on that debate, Karen?
You know, I think, and you're right, he had worked on it going back to 1965, where he pushed through the legislation that got rid of quotas and really opened the door for a lot of people to come to this country from places other than Northern Europe. I've thought all along that immigration reform was a long shot in the foreseeable future.
What do you think, EJ?
But just to save a call, LaGuardia went out of Congress in 1933 when he got elected mayor, but he was a very progressive Republican. I think it's immigration reform is very, very hard because the country is – there's no consensus in the country. There's about a third of us who are strongly in favor of something that would legalize the situation of illegal immigrants. There's about a third of us who are opposed to anything. We're basically restrictionist. And then there's a very sort of torn, sometimes confused, sometimes just uncertain middle that knows we can't deport everybody, but also is very uneasy about illegal immigration. The other problem is that if you look at who the swing votes are in the House, A lot of the Democratic seats that are up for grabs are seats where there's a very, very small Latino population, so that you have a lot of moderate to conservative Democrats who are very uneasy about this because they won't have the backing of the Latinos who helped Obama in the presidential election win in states like Colorado and Nevada, so that the congressional politics and the presidential politics of this are quite different.
Now, here's an email that reads, Senator Kennedy's staff has been praised as the best congressional staff. What happens to them now? This is from Rick, who writes this from Washington, D.C. Now, David Gergen, I'm assuming Rick is not himself on Senator Kennedy's staff and wondering what's going to happen. It is true that Senator Kennedy's staff has long had a reputation for being quite remarkable. Tell us about some of the people who, I know that some of them are now at the JFK school, people who have come from Senator Kennedy's staff to go on to do other big things.
Well, the alumni group is a very powerful, strong group, and it's always a badge of honor to have come from the Kennedy staff, and you find everyone from, a Supreme Court justice like Stephen Breyer to people in the White House in significant positions today like Melody Barnes, who's the domestic advisor, and Greg Craig, who's the chief counsel. You have people who are, all over Washington and people beyond that. Nick Littlefield, who sang so beautifully at the memorial service last Friday night, was a chief of staff for Ted Kennedy, and he's now one of the most important healthcare lobbyists/policy makers in the country, working out of the Foley Hoag, a Boston law firm. So that these, it was a Ted Kennedy liked talent. People liked to work for him. He was a wonderful boss to them. And it's hard to think of – the only other senator I can think of who attracted talent in quite the same way was Pat Moynihan. Tim Russert and many others were alumni from that office. And it made a big, big difference for Ted Kennedy to have people of that quality come work for him, be so joyous, and be a part of the extended Kennedy family. Let me just – if I could just add one footnote to go back to E.J. Yes, E.J., 57-58 Democrats is a significant majority in the Senate. What I was trying to make the point is – the question is there a majority in the country for the kind of reform that's being sought? And I would suggest right now it's an uphill fight for the president to get the country to swing around behind a House-type bill in health care.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. EJ.
I just want to second what David said about the Kennedy staff. The smartest people in this world know how much they don't know. Know-it-alls are not the smartest people in the world. Kennedy knew how important a good staff was, and it's really extraordinary, the people who work for him. Of course, David and I think, agree that President Obama needs to get out there and reframe the public argument. He does need to win the public over to this. One of the most interesting things I've heard last week, Tom Perriello, young congressman from a very conservative district in Virginia, very progressive, he had been to 16 town meetings at the point I talked to him. He said, look, these rooms are divided. The right talks about socialism and big government. The left talks about corporate accountability and the public plan. And the middle talks about the cost of health care and all their problems in health care. You're not going to win the right. You're going to have to hold the left. And you've got to make a case to the middle that this plan, whatever it is, and Obama's got to be more specific, will improve the very things they're upset about. It's very strange that we've gone from talking about what we wanted to fix in the health system to the idea that the government's just going to make things worse. Obama's got to change that equation again.
We should answer Rick's question. Karen, what actually happens to Kennedy's staff? Do they stay on board until there's a new senator or what?
I know they're on for a while, but I suspect there is going to be a great talent hunt by the other members of the Senate who have been restrained from ever being allowed to poach Kennedy's staff.
Here's an email.
Well, the White House. The White House ought to make an effort to bring him into all these unfilled positions.
Who now takes over Senator Kennedy's position as chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee? Karen?
Well, the speculation, of course, has been that his good friend Senator Dodd, who took over in his stead in his absence, would take the post. But Senator Dodd is also the chairman of the Banking Committee, so who knows?
And the next one down the line, I think, is Senator Harkin from Iowa, but he's got a big job himself.
And he's chair of agriculture, which just happens to be important to his state of Iowa, so he might be unwilling to give that up, although he would be a very powerful fighter for health care reform. He is a strong progressive and always has been and keeps getting reelected in a state that's probably in principle less liberal than he is, or at least used to be.
David Gergen, we spent much of this hour talking about Senator Kennedy and his legacy see as such an effective legislator. We just have a few seconds left. Tell us briefly what made Senator Kennedy so effective in Washington.
He was a man who was serious about governance. He really cared about leaving behind and getting work done. And as Chris Dodd said, he was a secret to the success was that people liked him. He was impossible not to like. And that combination and his, you know, he was not the brightest guy in his family. He was, you know, he was always regarded as a bit of a laggard within the family itself. But he had an instinct for governance and for legislating that I think it reminds one very much of Lyndon Johnson, a completely different kind of personality, but the best legislator since Johnson.
All right. David Gergen, Karen Tumulty, E.J. Dionne, thanks so much for being with us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.